So, welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of a couple of dozen such lodges around the world, each following an autonomous path, but all sharing the declared purposes that are on the back of the periodical that you can find at the front of either the book table or the usher's table. And so I'd like to share this declaration with you. It's profound, but very concise. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Here in Philadelphia, the folks that have associated themselves with the cause of the theosophical movement volunteer completely on the basis of these declared purposes. And as volunteers, they keep things rolling along, and the activities fall on a couple of days a week, Wednesdays and Sundays. On Wednesdays, the library opens at 5:15 and stays open until 7:15. It's a study library or a reference library. It's available to everyone. There's always a volunteer available to help with an individual line of research, or if someone wants to study something to get ready for a Wednesday night class or a Sunday morning presentation, or if you heard something that piqued your interest and you'd like to see what the reference was, there's a student that can help. Also during library hours on Wednesday nights, there's a student at the book table. So if you're someone who still likes to hold hard texts and underline and make comments in margins, you can avail yourself of literature, pamphlets, brochures, texts of all kinds at cost. There's no profit made whatsoever. Whatever the lodge pays in terms of shipping and purchase is the only thing that's asked. In the meantime, however, if you've made the transition into the digital age and you'd rather read an electronic copy or print out something at home and do all that for free, available at the book table are little address cards of how to get to a website run by the Phoenix ULT, and there all of the literature is free because, again, this is considered a birthright to each and every human being. On Wednesday nights, promptly at 7:30, lasting until 8:30, there is a study class, if you will. We're using an anthology from the late 1800s This is a collation of newspaper articles written by William Q. Judge, and they're wonderful in that they're a synopsis of, or an overview of, the massive Secret Doctrine volumes that H.P. Blavatsky was able to publish in the late 1800s. So it's a more informal presentation. Someone summarizes the part. There's ample time for discussion and questions. And the basic concepts of the philosophy are gone into. On Sunday mornings, what we have available is a morning like today. The building opens at 10:30. There's a volunteer at the book table in case you want to make an inquiry about something. And then promptly at 11, lasting until 12, there's a more formal presentation of some aspect of the philosophy. For the coming month, the theme is going to be the path of spiritual evolution. So that would be the overriding Sunday morning theme for January 2020. The first Sunday, January 5th, there'll be a panel presentation entitled The Power of Intention and Will. And again, there'll be presentations and then a time for discussion thereafter. I'm still working with an old declaration. There's not a new one up here, but I understand that there will now be library hours on Friday nights in addition.
Same hours, 5:15 to 7:15.
I'm sorry.
5:15 to 7:15.
Okay, 5:15 to 7:15. Again, it's a reference library. Thank you very much. And that will begin this coming Friday night and will be every Friday night thereafter. And again, there'll be someone there to assist with any line of investigation. If what you hear here strikes a tone in your heart, if you feel a rising commitment, if you will, to any of the efforts in order to keep the building together and open or to help out in any way, shape, or form, everything is voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. Everything is based on individual conscience and heartfelt association with the cause. As the Declaration says, there are absolutely no constitution, bylaws, app, officers, tithing, whatever. Doesn't happen here. That's not what we're about. Now, this morning, we are finishing up our December presentations. The whole month of December, we've been looking at the overall theme of cycles and cyclic law. And this morning, the title for the talk is New Year, New Cycle. Sure to be a good one, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion.
New year, new cycle. Throughout Isis Unveiled, many passages point to the silent influences of cycles traced in history, not by dates and events, but by noting the causes and conditions created by the nature of the religious and scientific thought of any age. Cycles, which befittingly have been called the wheels of eternity, are both repetitive and progressive. Cycle means return of that which was before. There is the cycle of day and night, the cycle of the four seasons, and the yearly cycles. Every day and every year is a cyclic opportunity to craft for yourself a new and glorious morn. Tough to say that without singing it. Let me repeat that. Every day and every year is a cyclic opportunity to craft for yourself a new and glorious morn, a new beginning, if you would. As the calendar comes to an end, we consider the coming year, reflecting how we will act within it, and pondering over the past year. We turn to H.P. Blavatsky for some thoughts on this time in the cycle. She writes the following: "To mankind, there comes a new and fresh vigor to all his channels of life, from within outwards, gradually strengthening as the sun moves nearer. The ancients, being aware of this fact and realizing that life is one through all its manifestations, took advantage of the birth of the year to reaffirm their aspirations, thus consciously seizing the opportune time. Let no one imagine that it is a mere fancy, the attaching of importance to the birth of the year. The earth passes through its definite phases, and man does too. And as a day can be colored, so can a year. The astral life of the earth is young and strong between Christmas and Easter. Those who form their wishes now will have added strength to fulfill them constantly. Every day and a year is an opportunity to examine the thoughts, feelings, actions, and also the reactions and responses to those thoughts and feelings, from which will emerge the prospective vision of the future. We must examine and analyze that past, not from the point of view of our bodily age, but from that of our mental creativity. What have I achieved as a soul and as a thinker during that past? What shall I do with past errors, past meanness, past selflessness, past laziness? In hurting others, we have wounded ourselves. In robbing others, we have impoverished ourselves. But brooding over and reliving the past is a total waste of time and effort. We are asked not to regret the past, but to learn from the past. The suggestion is to forget the emotional experiences attached to the past events that tend to take control of our mind and color the present and the future. Once we have extracted the lesson from an event, we must let it pass without brooding over it. Our capacity to do good in the present is adversely affected when we dwell over the past, which drags us down from our present level of consciousness. Let us examine the past and recognize our follies, our ambitions, our pride. Once we have recognized our mistakes and limitations, we must try to find the remedy. Thus, with the cycle of recognition, begins also the cycle of aspiration. These two cycles of recognition and aspiration meet in the present. Past follies and hopes join hands, and each one of us can give them a right direction by the sincere quest for truth and wisdom. When we look inquiringly and expectantly to the future, that represents hope. And hope is a theological virtue which suggests that if we struggle, we can do better. From wherever we are, there is a way leading to a state of unconditional happiness. As a first step, we must resolve to make a new beginning by eradicating all that stood in the way of living the soul life, and to bring in things which will enable us to lead a better and a nobler life and become a better human being. As the sun moves northward from December 21st, the days become longer, bringing more light, more warmth and more brightness. Just as in the entire day, the physical and psychic atmosphere of the early morning is most conducive for study and meditation, so also this time of year is best suited to make resolves. From the ancient times and among all people and all belief systems, the beginning of the year was marked as an occasion with deep meaning. The beginning of the year has always had a relation to the winter solstice, the return of the sun from its farthermost course, a return which brings with it the revivifying influences to all the kingdoms of nature. The influences touch the inner life of all forms and give a renewed impetus to expansion and growth. So we see the reasons for this natural inclination lying hidden in the depths of our own being. We have a natural perception of occult law in our observance of this particular period of the year. When the sun rays become warmer and stronger, all the other forces behind the sun itself and behind ourselves become stronger within us. In the rising wave of spiritual and psychic renewal, all that we desire to do has a greater impulsion than at any other time of the year. All the powers that exist or can exist are latent, however ill-expressed, in the spiritual nature. We were once conscious of our spiritual nature, but as we came down through the planes of expression to this plane of matter, we acquired a growth in intellectuality at the expense of our spiritual perception. To realize our own true natures, we must begin at the highest point of our nature by assuming that it is, and by holding to the power of that assumption. We begin to see light, to feel warmth, by the very power of that affirmation of the spiritual nature. This time of year helps us to reconnect with those hidden ideas, hidden only until we decide to lift the veil and remember. We must learn to recognize an evolution under the law both true and merciful, which operates everywhere. Under the law of cycles, there is a periodical return of impressions, and hence the tendency each year to make New Year's resolutions. We could, by an understanding and using of the law of recurrence, bring into effect those resolutions. Let us then be mindful of the cycles and seasons. Let us remember who and what we truly are within. And let us act in a way, always, which honor those truths. Once again, the topic for today, New Year, New Cycle.
And I'm sure you all came this morning prepared for new thought. Yes?
Besides the upward impulse in nature that's felt at this time of year, is there anything we add to our success through the power of a vow or a promise, a resolution, if you will, a sincere? Mm-hmm.
The power of a vow, if done selflessly, if done in a heartfelt, altruistic way, is an energized moment, isn't it? Where heart and mind and will and imagination all come together in a focus, and the human spirit adds oomph to it, adds energy to it, sends it off into a sphere of influence that can affect everyone. So when we're thinking about resolutions and vows and making promises, we know that in the mundane world, you know, there's all sorts of... the big joke at the gym is that you don't want to go during the month of January because all the newbies are going to show up, take over all the space. They'll all be gone by the 1st of February. That's not the kind of vow, that's not the kind of resolution that a student of theosophy is thinking about. It is said here that the human is a dynamo, that all forces in nature are in potential in the human spirit moving through the human kingdom. And so with one point of concentration, with fixed imagination, fixed will, pure desire, to make a promise, to make a vow is a very sacred trust, not just for a particular personality, but for everything and everyone in the influence. There are wonderful articles, and see, this is why the reference library is so great. There's an article called Resolutions and the Power of a Vow. It's in Magazine Theosophy 16 on page 203, and it certainly is available for everybody to look into about why you would want to be very, very sure about what it is you're pledging to, what it is you're resolving or vowing to. Yeah.
Well, to who are you making this vow?
Ah. Therein is the philosophical difference between the mainstream Western society and the students who were looking at this ancient philosophy of theosophy. If we look at the word resolution, and you think it's really a re-solution, if you were, would. And embedded right in that word is S-O-L, Sol, the sun. So all of these are markers from very, very ancient times that the resolution made is from the lower aspect of the human being, the personality, the worldly, mundane appearance of that personality, turning inward and making a vow in the light of that higher power, that higher soul, that higher mind that is resident within. If we trace that back, that oneness of that higher essence of consciousness is one, and we are all radiance of that. But the vow process, the resolution, the resolution of life's problems, if you will, comes when there's a turning point where the student turns away from the personal mundane concerns and turns toward the principles and the powers and potential of the inner, of the spiritual side.
Well, do we have an idea or an ideal of what that is? What is the perfection of all these, this physical body? Where are we going? What is the purpose of all this then?
In 25 words or less?
15.
Okay. Where are we all going? The philosophy, and it was in the declaration, you know, a truer nature of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. If we premise that there is an absolute unknown, an abstract, if you will, beingness from which all manifestation radiates, ergo from spirit radiant into soul, the soul using a particular incarnation is divine in potential. And so that soul, working through the human state as it is now, has a remarkable dharma or duty. And that is to impress, uplift, energize, enlightened, whatever kind of concept you want to try to use in English, to uplift all soul in all forms, in all states and conditions of consciousness. And so what it's all about is not necessarily just fitting oneself by personality and physical frame to be the better able to help and teach others, but to fit oneself from the mundane into the spiritual so that that oneness is once again realized. And we've got evidence of this in all cultures, on all continents, across all time periods. There's some that think about the Christos. There's some that think about the Krishna. There are others that are talking about, look within, thou art Buddha. Throughout time is this notion that soul is, and that soul is the force, the ability to enlighten and uplift all. Yeah.
In light of how our minds work, and we're starting our resolutions from the lower aspect, is it better for us to make a positive resolution or say we won't do something?
Ah, it's always better in terms of a resolution to remain will-centered, because it's a form of will prayer. I will do something, whatever the design is, in the light of the spirit, in the light of the soul, for the good of all. And so if we take that positive approach, and some of us use behavioral cognition techniques that are actually as old as the Bhagavad Gita, but are now reframed in the modern world, so that the idea is to take a positive, willful, as purely altruistic stand as we can imagine, and then to hold that as an affirmation. And if we can imagine, what would it feel like to be or to do that? What would it look like to be or to do that? And we, in our times of meditation, morning and night, periodically through the day, if we can pull that off, we reiterate that positive force and let go of it. Yeah.
Well, to follow up, imagination was mentioned, and that's a power in itself, second only perhaps to the will. So if we make a negative resolution, we're reinforcing that negative image.
Yes.
And that's going to be like an anchor, or weigh us down in our progress.
Sure. And we know this from habit formation. You know, you tell a little child that, yeah, there's ice cream in the freezer, you can't have it. What are they going to be thinking about? Whereas if something is broached in a positive way, you have a couple of choices, you can do this, and then in the imagination, that's where the mind is held. This is possible, I can do, there's good reasons to do this, then that's where the growth comes. And again, as we heard in the talk, this time of the year, this cycle of the year, where the deciduous trees in the northern hemisphere look dead, we know that there's tremendous activity building, tremendous force arising in the entire system, and we can take advantage of that. Yeah.
If you heard me say, oh, I see what you mean, could you comment on that kind of comment?
I see what you mean. Gosh, there's so many different ways to apply that. Sometimes folks do a lot of public talking. They'll recite their prayers in public. They will talk about their dreams in public. They will publish their resolutions and their goals in public. And they're expending activity and force. But if we can walk our talk, if we can stride a path and show by word and deed, and show by our attempt to try to straighten out character and our use of all of the talents that are at the human avail, then people can say, oh, I see what you mean, because we're exemplifying what's really going on the inner. So if we're focused on the inner, we imagine the very best use that soul can make of the talents that we've got available. Others may see that and be affected by that. Yeah.
You used the term imagine. Yeah, we've heard it several times. What is it that we use to make an image? I thought you had to use hands.
Imagination is the king faculty, I think we read, don't we, from a lot of the ancient sources. And we know that there have been very horrific psychological experiments involving children, where teachers were told, this is going to be the worst class you've ever had in your entire life. This class has no talent. This class is unruly. They're nasty. They're blah, 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 whatever. When in reality, those children were randomly sampled and put together just like the classroom next door, where the teacher set was told, this is a talented and gifted group. They will be the stars of your career. And in the imagination of the listener come certain expectations. And with that imagining and anticipation, the children then proceed to either fail or to exceed expectations exactly like the adult was advised. And don't we do that with ourselves, with how we limit the imagination, the king faculty, with how we limit our ability to know that there's human desires and how to fine-tune them and how to place them. How we imagine ourselves, how we envision, what is it to be human? Is to be human a lowly, poor little worm of a sinner? Or is there some other degree of consciousness which has a deific bent, which has this tremendous, profound possibility for everyone and everything? Yeah.
Oftentimes you like to make more than one resolution. You want to sort of like clean up the mess right away. Oh. And is there any problem with, I never got around to that one, or I didn't really do that resolution. I'll catch it next year.
Well, when we allow ourselves to fritter away the use of our willpower and our imagination, and we allow what was once a lofty desire to atrophy and disintegrate, what are we doing? We're setting up cycles, and those cycles of causation are going to return again. So if we have negative resolutions, if we've got namby-pamby resolutions and then we procrastinate, or we've got too many and we just give up on it, we've set up new cycles and new habits that are going to recur. You know, it's often said that the past is something that comes rushing over our shoulder and creates the future. We carry it with us. And so if we determine that we're going to set up a resolution, we're going to set up a new cycle spiritually, it's very key to not just throw the pebble in the pond and then sit passively by and let the waves ripple back and forth until they dissipate. But it's very, very important for consistency and follow through, endurance if you want. Endeavor would be a great word, where there's a true melding of force and spiritual thought. Yeah.
follow up on that idea. We've heard that the Buddha taught that he who conquers one fault is better than the conqueror of nations. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, if we make a resolution, should we try to maybe limit it down, in order to have more force and power and focus, should we maybe just pick one to work on and be successful at, or three or four?
Well, you know, the new research on multitasking is that that actually diminishes capability across time, and that multitasking, while some people see it as an emergency necessity, it fritters energy out and confuses things, and eventually the efficiency of the effort is diminished. In the ancient texts, across time and place, are statements about remaining focused, remaining one-pointed in our point of view, so that if our aim is very, very exact, we're like the archer, so that regardless of what the wind is doing and what the rain is doing, we've still got to aim at that particular target. And we've got all systems honed forcefully into pulling back the arrow and letting it fly to hit that target. If we're trained along one line, we've conserved spiritual strength. We've added force to the process of the resolution. And we have, hopefully, more carry through, if you will. Yeah.
What relationship does Krishna have to me? Does Jesus have to me? Does Buddha have to me? You know, there's great people in our history that we look at and go, wow. You know, Plato, Pythagoras, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. But what does that mean to me? That's not me, that's somebody else. Is there a relationship that I should be aware of?
Mm-hmm. Well, logically speaking, because, I mean, we're in finite bodies and we're using finite brains right now. If there's nothing new under the sun, if indeed everything cycles, and if indeed there's universal law, a compassionate universal law of cause and effect, what we can see of a partial genius, maybe a musical prodigy or an artistic prodigy, or what we can read of these historical figures where supposedly miracles have been performed, what we're looking at is the flowering, the enlightenment of the human being and the potentiality that dwells within each and every single human being. There's a reason why in the ULT, the literature is considered free birthright for all of us. And we frequently joke about how we come together as fragments of a whole. Together we make one full human study of something. So if we're looking at the historical figures across time, and we recognize in ourselves, if that happened once, if that happened across time according to cycle and law and endeavor, can it not happen again? And if we've got these remarkable examples like Kuan Yin in the Asian world, where the vow of salvation was not unique to a particular individual, rather the vow, never will I pursue individual salvation alone, but always and forever and everywhere will pursue the salvation until every single spiritual entity reaches an unconditioned, fully manifest, fully enlightened self. So we look at the Christos, we look at the Buddha, and that wonderful statement of don't follow me, follow the path I show, because thy Father is in heaven, the same as any of those fathers were in heaven. Yeah.
Well, we hear in these rooms these words, and one stuck with us. It says, every failure is success. Repeat the failures and become full of success. A lot of times, you try two or three times, I give it up. Here, we're given these words. Every failure is success. Repeat the failure. So when we make our resolution, we have to think about being free from this idea of personality, me, 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 and think more openly. New Year.
To humbly think more selflessly, as best we can. And certainly there's a spectrum, isn't it? Isn't there? From the incredibly selfish narcissist all the way up through stages of self-centered, for maybe personal reasons, or self-centered, self-care spiritually, trying to improve to help someone else, all the way up to the extreme of the pure compassion examples of the selflessness of these great religious philosophers and human thought leaders, if you will. In terms of failure, you know, you have to smile because you have to have a sense of humor, because sometimes after years of mental rehearsing and working on character development and trying to heal the old wounds of the heart or the old holes in the heart, the cycles turn, don't they? And there will be a situation that comes back and it's almost an echo of what happened so very long ago. And just when we thought we had it all together, so we weren't going to fall into the same pit or the same hole in the sidewalk, the situation returns. But why? Because compassionate law represents scenarios so that there's not an obstacle, but there's an availability, there's an opportunity to learn. So in many ways, becoming more and more aware of returning cycles, making an effort daily to try to think about the events of the day and how we reacted to them and why and how we reacted to them. Sometimes that process of failure, but failure confronted, noted, thought about, and then don't dwell on it, just let it go. But that kind of creative process is where we need to be. Yeah.
So out in the world, you know, there's so many folks who know about making resolution. Most everybody thinks about it and makes this resolution. And it's more of kind of a, like a community tradition or even to the point of superstition, but let's do it anyway because it's fun to do and this time I'm going to do it, you know. But the student theosophy recognizes or accepts or has studied that really there's a science behind it. And it's not superstitious in the least. But how would someone who comes to a lecture like this, a discussion of ideas, how would they go out to a friend who has no idea about theosophy and present this simple idea of resolutions in a way that is just inherently obvious or intellectually, like it's unquestionable, that would be the right word, but to demonstrate that there's a real science behind it, and the more you look into it, the more you come to recognize the truth of it.
I guess it depends on the individual that you're approaching, doesn't it? If a family member or a friend or an acquaintance at business is very happy with what appears to us to be a superstitious, partying, kind of mundane process, if they're not seeking more information, perhaps the best we can do is just to say, oh yeah, you know, that's an ancient tradition, really focused on January 4th, not the 1st, for very, very good reasons. And then let that drop and see if they have another question. And depending on the question asked, then you can start to think about using the analogy of the forces of great nature right now in the Northern Hemisphere appearing to be dormant, latent, and dead, but they're not. So this is a great time of year to get up and going, the same as nature. If they've got a historical bent, then you can go through, there's a wonderful little old pamphlet, this is from Mumbai from many years ago, where the article says that January 4th, which is what ought to be selected by theosophists for their new year, January is under the sign of Capricorn, the mysterious Makara of the Hindu mystics, and for very many ages, the 4th of January has been sacred to Mercury, Buddha, to Thoth, Hermes, and the list goes on. Buddha, known by the Aryan name, Mercurius or Mercury, the son of two other gods, which would be Hellenic. So it's Greco-Egyptian, if you will, as well. So it depends on the person that we're trying to assist, because the process is always to become aware of the need or the call of the other, if there is one, and then empower that one to look for things that interest them, for themes of life that might be recurring, that's their line of study. Do you have another idea about it?
Well, this list that was read of these ancient civilizations that recognized January 4th as this special point in the cycle, that just adds to the amazement that, you know, January 4th, probably most people know, is the day of the year when the planet Earth is closest to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the perihelion. And how on earth would those ancient civilizations actually know that? But yet they recognize it as some kind of a sacred point in a cycle.
I wish I had spent more attention in class with science, because the ancient true teachings of astrology, not the horoscopes we've got today, but the real study of the skies, the pure astronomy, the ancient folks had a great deal of sensitivity and wisdom about the role of the skies and how that could mark cycles and how that would mark durations of periods and cause and effect. The whole notion of that sun, January 4th is also called the birth of the Dhyani Buddhas, that there is this coming of this spiritual force at the very beginning of the cosmos. And we know that if we look at our physical sun, it can be used as an analogy and a symbol for so much power, for heat and warmth and everything that we measure in life, and that we know that the sunspots and the eruptions on the sun's surface can finagle all sorts of radio waves and TV signals, and this student doesn't pretend to understand the technology of it. But the ancients, living in a less complicated world perhaps, like children, closer to inception, pure in their recall in certain ways, knew great nature intimately. We're blinded by the lights. We live by the electricity. We no longer really live by the rise and the setting of the sun. Very few of us do that. But if you're in an agrarian society or hunting-gathering society and you're living close to nature, right from the beginning, the impress of what it is to be human spirit and to be wise is reflected aboundingly in all symbols in great nature, including the sun, including the force that might go on between December 21st and March 20th. It's embedded in myth and legend and folk tales and children's nursery songs. It's everywhere. And we kind of forget to think about it the same way as we say resolution, not re-solution, not re-sol, realignment with the sun, with the spirit. Your hand went up and down quite a while ago. I'm sorry.
It's okay. We were just thinking about the image of the Roman god Janus, the two-faced, one facing the future, one facing the past. And we thought it was curious that the Greeks actually had, from what we understand, they had no equivalent god. So it was actually a kind of a Roman thing.
Right.
And it also symbolized the beginning of peace, or the beginning of war, or peace, and gates opening and closing. So there's a lot of imagery there.
And it's interesting that you bring that up, because so many of us, especially in the Western world, get so hung up on self-flagellation over what was. How did we waste our talents? What wrongs did we commit? There's like a grieving and this possibility of imagining and getting caught in a rut and a repetition of sorrowing over past wrongdoings. Then there's another portion of the population that doesn't want to know anything about what they used to do. Their angst is anticipation for the future and what's going to be. Their consciousness is way out in front of them, and they're solving scenarios and spending money that they don't even have yet. So that two-facedness, there's actually that pivot point, isn't there? And the pivot point is in the consciousness in the moment, the mindfulness of the moment, where what we have is the eternal moment. I am that I am now, right now. I started this sentence in the past. I'm going to finish my sentence in the future, but I'm in creation of the sentence right now. And that's the unfolding of life, but a lot of folks just aren't thinking about it yet. Your hands up?
Yeah, just I guess sort of more of a comment or some kind of discussion starter that I was just bouncing around my head when I was like looking around the room kind of. And so I noticed that on this side of the room there's these two of the same shape, and over here there's the window, and then over here there's the door. And the window, the light is coming in, and to me this represents imagination over here. And then if you look, there's like a live plant under the window that's being nurtured by the imagination, but it's sort of unruly. And then whereas if you look over by the door, there's like a plant that is arranged, but it's in a vase, so it's not, it's temporarily alive, but it will die. And so, and then there's something about like, there's this infinite source of light coming in, but we can't go out the window. And there's also something to do with this side of the room is raised, that this is the more like, there's divinely inspired, but if you want to actually go to that world, you have to go out the door. And then something about the resolution cycle of, since those plants eventually die, you will eventually need to go back to this unruly imagination and prune off more and put it in the vase. I don't really know where that leads. But just, something about the that the human, the self is in between these, sitting in the middle, something like that.
Wow. Now there's the power of human awareness, discernment, imagination, creativity, the use of analogy and correspondences and all sorts of symbols. And there's the goal, moment by moment, of moving through life, being consciously centered enough to look around and start saying, wow, how is that like something loftier? If we're locked into using these conditions of this physical frame and this physical brain, that's okay. The human spirit and mind, totally unfettered, is what holds the key to eternal wisdom. The Christ, the Buddha, the Krishna, all started in that process. And really, if you think about it, and you look at most toddlers and young children, they're centered in that until something in life knocks it out of them, knocks them off course, traumatizes them in some way. And they lose some of that exuberance, I want to say, or creativity or exploration. But there's the key. So thank you for that. Yeah.
Keeping in mind the cycle and the teaching of the astral life of the earth being young, if we make our resolutions at this time of the cycle, is there a time we might witness in the year of the fruition of that? We might see, hey, this is really lawful. I've made the effort then, I'm going to see the results by a certain time of the year. Anything about that?
Well, do we know anything in life that's totally linear, that has a beginning and an end, so incredibly finite that there really is nothing else? Or do we think of cycles, you know, that the sine curve that appears throughout life, and turned on end, it becomes a spiral, doesn't it? So depends on the resolution and our use of substance. If we start one small change, some tiny change, it may very well be that looking back, especially if we can journal about it, if we dedicate ourselves to self-awareness and journaling, we may see that although that one tiny change has been made, it has spawned many, many other changes. And so these cycles of all sorts of interplay of causes are really limitless. They're as limitless as the human being. If the Christos and the Buddha is within each and all, and we are spiritually all at one, the process is limitless and endless. But we're out of time. So Wednesday night, there's going to be library hours and ocean class on higher and lower mind. And then Friday night will be the grand debut of the Friday night library hours. The meeting's adjourned. And Happy New Year.